We've been discussing Isaiah chapter 7. We were in the midst of looking at verses 13 through 16, the end of the last hour. Remember, I indicated there are generally three ways in which those verses have been treated by interpreters. Some have tried to apply them all to the current situation of the Syro-Ephraimic War and assume that the sign of the birth in verse 14 is a child born either to Ahaz or to Isaiah. Others have tried to apply the entire passage to the birth of Christ. And on the basis of the Matthew citation of this verse, which does apply it to Christ, conclude that the entire passage is speaking of that. Neither of them, those two alternatives, seem to do justice to the specifics of the passage, because in verse 13, there seems to be rebuke to Ahaz, "Hear ye now, O house of David, it is a small thing to be weary men, but be weary my God also." Verses 15 to 16 seem very clearly to speak of the contemporary situation, particularly verse 16. "Before the child shall know to refuse to eat one food, good, the land of God's word shall be taken by both teams." Seems that can't be exclusively applied to the birth of Christ. So that's led some to advocate a multiple or dual fulfillment in which the passage speaks both of a contemporary child, perhaps Hezekiah or Isaiah, and also of Christ. I gave you Walter Kaiser as an illustration of that. That raises an unrootable issue of dual or multiple sense, which we discussed last quarter, so I think we need to be very careful about. But it also raises the question of the meaning of the term Alma, which used in Hebrew term Alma, which is used in verse 14, which is translated King James Version, as well as in NIV. The virgin shall conceive. If this is Isaiah's son, Isaiah's son, how can that apply to the mother of those children? Now, I indicate at the end of the hour that it seems to me best to take the verses as words of rebuke to Ahaz on the one hand. You are an unworthy representative of the house of David. You will be replaced. So, on the one hand, words of rebuke to Ahaz, but on the other hand, directed to a different audience, words of comfort to the godly people still in the land. And verse 13 is rebuke to Ahaz, whereas 15 and 16 are comfort to the godly people in the land. The thing that can bind those two together is something I think you have to bring to the text. And admittedly, that's the difficult part of the interpretive situation here. But the thing that can bind them together is to say that on the assumption that this child, which is spoken of in verse 14, on the assumption that he were to be born within the year, within a normal term of pregnancy, then those two things would be gone. In other words, it's not that the prophecy is saying he will be born then, but if you use the term of pregnancy as a basis for measurement of time, assuming he were to be born, not that he will be, but assuming that he were to be born presently, then these things would be gone before he would know enough to distinguish right and wrong, before the child could know to refuse to eat and refuse to do. So I don't think the prophecy says specifically when the one is coming. Leave that open. The assumption is if he were to come within a year, before he was more than a few years old, the two pregnant things would be gone. Now, I wanted to see, I discussed that in the last class hour. I want to go a bit further with this question of the Alma in verse 14. The Hebrew term there is Alma. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son. I think that that is a strong objection to understanding the specifics of verse 14 to be referring either to the king's wife or the wife of Isaiah. There's no reason to conclude that Ahaz's wife was a virgin or that the wife of Isaiah was a virgin. In fact, we know that Isaiah had a son, Shear Jacob, in the early part of verse 7. He went out to meet Ahaz and confront him. The Lord said, take your son, Shear Jacob, at verse 3. Now, there have been a number of interpreters who have argued that Alma does not really mean virgin. It means young woman. And therefore, the term might refer to Isaiah's wife or to Ahaz's wife. And in fact, if you look at the Revised Standard Version translation of Isaiah 7:14, it says in the text, behold, the young woman shall conceive and bear a son. There is a footnote in the RSV which says, or virgin, but that's put in a footnote. If you look at the New English Bible, it says, the young woman will conceive, and there isn't any footnote. It just leaves it at that. So it removes entirely any suggestion the idea of virgin birth. Now, the question is then, what does this term Alma mean? Let me make a few comments on that. First, Alma is not the usual word which is translated virgin. When you come across the term virgin in Jewish version, it is normally the translation of a different Hebrew word, not of Alma. Normally, the word that's translated virgin is Bethula. And you might say, well, if Bethula is the term that's normally virgin, why didn't Isaiah use Bethula instead of Alma? Wouldn't it have been clearer? Look at your citation there, question page 17. First paragraph, top of the page. This is taken from D.J. Young, volume 1 of his three-volume commentary on Isaiah, page 288. First paragraph there. Young says, in Joel 1:8, the Bethula is clearly a married woman. And in later Aramaic incantation texts, the Aramaic equivalent of Bethula refers to a married woman. If Isaiah had used this word, Bethula, he would have left us in confusion. We could not have known precisely what he had in mind. Would he have been speaking of one who was truly a virgin? Or would he rather have had in mind one who was betrothed or one who was actually a wife? In the light of these considerations, it appears that Isaiah's choice of Alma was deliberate. It seems to be the only word in the language which unequivocally signifies an unmarried woman. No other available Hebrew word would clearly indicate that the one whom it designates was unmarried. Consequently, no other word would have been suitable for fulfilling the requirements of the sign, such as the context demanded. None of these other words would have pointed to an unusual birth. Only Alma makes clear that the mother was unmarried. Next paragraph. If, however, the mother is an unmarried woman, the question arises. Was the child illegitimate or not? If the child were illegitimate, would such a birth be a sign? The whole context, indeed the whole biblical context, rules this out. On the other hand, if the mother were a good woman, then the birth was out of the ordinary, an unusual birth. The mother is both unmarried and a good woman. When this fact is understood, it becomes apparent that in all history, there's only one of whom this can be predicated, namely Mary, the mother of the Lord. Now you notice what Young does there. He lays stress, for the meaning of the term Alma, he lays stress on the unmarried state more than on the virginity aspect of the meaning of the word. Not that the word doesn't include the idea of virginity, but the central significance of the word Alma seems to be unmarried. If you look at it in usage. The confusion with Bacola is, it's not always an unmarried woman. Joel 1:8, clearly, it's not an unmarried woman. So, the term indicates an unmarried woman. Secondly, the term Alma is used only 7 times in the Old Testament. If you look at those instances of usage, you find in no cases it's used of a married woman, so it indicates an unmarried woman. And in at least one occurrence, it's clear that the word designates one who is not only unmarried, but who is also a virgin. And that's in Genesis 24. You turn to Genesis 24, that's the story of Abraham sending his servant to find a wife for Isaac. And there's some interesting terminology used. If you look at verse 43 of Genesis 24, you read, this is the servant speaking, "Behold, I stand by the well of water. To come to pass that when the Alma cometh forth to draw water," that's translated King James Version. "When the Alma cometh forth to draw water, and I say to her, give me, I pray, a little water from my pitcher to drink, she says to me, both drink thou, and I will also draw for thy countenance," and so forth. Compare that verse 43, when you use the term Alma, with verse 16. If you back up to 15, you read that behold, Rebecca came out, who was born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, wife of Nahor, Abram's brother, with her pitcher on her shoulder. The damsel, that is not a rod. The damsel was very fair to look upon. A virgin, Bethula, they get the use of the term Bethula. A virgin, but then notice how Bethula is qualified. Neither had any man known her. See, there's some ambiguity with Bethula. Yet here, that ambiguity is taken away when it says that she was Bethula, neither had any man known her, and she went down to the well and filled her pitcher and came up. Now, you see, you have in this chapter not Arah, Bethula, and Alma, all used of Rebecca. And the context makes it very clear she was unmarried and she was a virgin. So, Dr. McCray, I remember years back, had suggested a story. You're going to try to define the term Alma. He suggests, as a definition, an unmarried or a young woman of marriageable age. A young woman of marriageable age. One of these characteristics is the virgin. A young woman of marriageable age, one of these characteristics is virgin. Now, the third consideration is the way in which the Septuagint translators treated Isaiah 7:14. When they translated this into Greek, the question is, how did they understand the phrase, "Behold the Alma shall conceive"? If you look at the Septuagint, you find that they translated the word with the Greek term parthenos. which is normally also translated burden. If you go to Matthew 1, verse 18, I believe it is. Matthew 1:23, behold, the virgin shall be with child, that is also parthenos. Now, some have argued that settles the case. The Greek translators use the term for virgin in the Greek that gives us a clear understanding, and that's quoted in the New Testament, so that it's clear that Alma in Isaiah 7:14 means virgin. However, not quite as straightforward as that. For this reason, parthenos is also ambiguous, much like Bethulia is. Look at your citation selection, page 13. Bottom of the page. This is taken from Harry Orlinsky's article on virgin in the Interpretive Dictionary of the Bible Supplement. He says, whether the parthenos was a virgin or not was a secondary matter to be determined if possible by the context. Indeed, the derived term hoparthenios denoted the son of an unmarried woman, and hey parthenos was sometimes used honorifically for the sacred prostitutes of Greek shrines. Thus the name Parthenos, which is a temple in Athens. When early Christianity developed, the belief of the virgin birth for Jesus, when early Christianity developed the belief of the virgin birth for Jesus, it was natural to point to a possible proof text in Isaiah 7:14. The exclusive meaning virgin was assumed for parthenos in captivity, and consequently for the Hebrew term which is translated Alma. But what he points out there, you see, is that parthenos, much like the fuller, is not always totally clear because of some usages which obscure that. Notice he says, whether parthenos indicates virgin or not needs to be determined by context. And that's where I think the Matthew context is also important, because look at Matthew 1:18. Matthew 1:18 says, now the birth of Jesus was in this way, when, as his mother Mary was espoused to Joseph, before they came together, she was found with child of the Holy Spirit. And see, when you put the use of parthenos in the context of that qualifier again, that's much like the qualifier back in Genesis 24 with Bethulia, it becomes quite clear that the use of parthenos in Matthew 1:23 is to indicate virginity, because before they came together, she was found with child. And then you notice in verse 25, to make it doubly clear, and he knew her not till she had brought forth her firstborn son, and he called his name Jesus. So there can be no question at all in Matthew 1, which is a double qualifier. You might say this use of the term parthenos that is indicative of Jesus. Seems to me quite clear, get back to Isaiah chapter 7, you're talking in verse 14 of a virgin birth. It seems very difficult to apply that to either Hezekiah or the son of Isaiah. It seems to be a prophecy of the coming of Christ. So, verse 13 is rebuked to Ahaz, you are going to be replaced, and then assuming if a child were to be born within the year. Verses 15 and 16, of comfort, not rebuke, but comfort to these godly remnants. These two things will be gone by which you were threatened. So 15 and 16, you have a transition of thought, no continuation of rebuke to Ahaz, but words of comfort to God's people. Page 15 of your citation, bottom of the page, last paragraph. I think I read this the last time. Basholt suggests in his article, 1987, after Isaiah's long-range pronouncement, the prophet turns to the other immediate peril, the Syro-Ephraimite coalition. He follows a pattern particularly prominent in his writings. He supports his long-range predictions which may be observed by his contemporaries. And fine, Isaiah makes two predictions. Long-range prophecy in Isaiah 7:14-15 that Matthew reports is fulfilled, and short-range prophecy in Isaiah 7:16 for his audience to witness. Now, whether you break it between 15 and 16 or between 14 and then 15 and 16 together, we could discuss further. Any questions or comments over up to at this point? Yes, you can. Okay. Problems. I think to me, what gives this suggestion something to be desired over the others is that I think it has less problems than alternative problems. I mean, you're forced, this is difficult, you're forced into options, none of which are something that you might, you know, read it once and say, this is what the text is saying. There's some difficult interpretive problems here. You'll hold the thing on eight for a minute. I won't go on into eight. I understand eight, much like Bullock does, but here's a short-term prediction that certifies the validity by its short-term fulfillment of the long-term prediction which remains yet to be fulfilled. I don't think we can equate the child of chapter 8 with the child of chapter 7, because the child of chapter 8 is the son of Isaiah, quite clearly. That child is not a virgin birth. Besides, that's a different name. The name is Marishal Hamaka. It's not Emmanuel. So there are two children. There's one who is born immediately, in fact, more quickly, you might say, than the one in chapter 7. Because the one in chapter 7, it says, before the child shall know to distinguish between good and evil, those two kings will be drawn. The one in chapter 8, it says, before you'll be able to say, Abiyam, my father, my mother, which is probably earlier, you know, it would be within a year. So the prophecy in chapter 8 must have been a bit later, fulfilled more quickly. But it's a different child, it has a different name, it certainly doesn't have a virgin for a mother. I don't think you can say the one in chapter 8 is the same as the one in chapter 7.
Does the child in chapter 8, you're saying that
child is not. The child in chapter 8 fulfills a similar purpose, yes, but it does it even more quickly. And in other words, it seems to me, in chapter 7, you have a child that is born immediately, and then before it distinguished good from evil. If born within the year, before it's distinguished from the evil, those two things would be gone. In some chapter 8, you have a child that perhaps have a gap of a year or so between the prophecy of chapter 7 and the prophecy of chapter 8. It's given later. The child in chapter 8 is. Instead of before it can distinguish good and evil, it simply has before it can say, I believe in me.
The problem will be solved. Verse 4. Before the child shall have the knowledge to cry, my father and my mother, the riches, mass, spoils, Samaria shall be taken away before the king.
Assyria. So it seems that this is a shorter term thing than this was. It seems that the child here is a different name and has a different color. It is true, referring to the same sort of problem, giving you time concerning the resolution of that problem. But it's a different sign. It seems like it's a shorter term study. And it is. So if you're talking about two different children, two different prophecies, given at two different times, they have a relationship to the same issue. Yes. But that's the only point of similarity. And then, this, the fulfillment of which can be observed, first of the child, really can serve as an authentication of the authenticity of this prophecy, the fulfillment of which, with respect to the birth of the child, is in the indeterminate future. It's the child. It doesn't say when and where they come. What I meant by that was, if you look at English versions, the New Testament version, normally you'll see behind it in Hebrew the page. The term itself, the Torah, is ambiguous. Because if you go to Joel, what was it, Joel 1:8? For example, Joel 1:8 says, lament like a virgin, the fool, girded with sackcloth for the husband of her youth. That sentence seems clearly to use it as one. So the fool has a certain ambiguity to it. You look at UC Jabalman, you never find a Jew in context where the woman is married. Seems like it. Although, that Genesis 24 is the only passage where you have an extended enough narration around the usage of terms to add this element of virginity. It's clear in 24 that virginity is an aspect of the meaning of the term. The other class, the other term, is, you can't tell. I would think so. Yeah. I follow what you said. In other words, before Christ was born, those things were gone. That's obvious that that's true. But then you might say, how much relevance does it add to the people who are wondering? Here we are being threatened to be occupied, or hearing, and what word of comfort is it to those gathered people that this is not going to happen. In other words, if you take it in the immediate context, those people are being told within 2 to 3 years
the problem from the beginning. So it's not something to be concerned about. If you put it in that long-term, uncertain, distant future, it really isn't a very comfortable one. Well, to me that's difficult to do. The other way, the people do have a knowledge of certainty that this is a short-term problem and within a few years it will be cleared up. I think that they heard a prophecy. Look, Ahaz is an unworthy occupant of the throne of David. He's going to be replaced. If a child were born today or within the year, before that child was more than a couple of years old, and then you see the birth of the child, it simply means there's a basis of time measurement. It's not being said the child will be born, but if he will be born. It seems to me that that's the way to hold the two ends of this thing together. It's difficult any other way, it seems to me. Well, square in the next step, I think. And it seems to be a parallel between the two. See if we talk. The prophets in Jewish tradition were pretty, put her away from the betrothal. A betrothal in the Jewish tradition is something a lot more serious, I'll tell you, than an engagement in that tradition. So thus, it couldn't be just, broken in a very easy manner. It's very serious thing for a betrothal. Yes? I wouldn't argue with that. I think the question, though, with your proposal is whether it doesn't make that last phrase all but meaningless, particularly for the people that are very strong. Let's go further. This is a difficult interpretive problem, and you can think further on it before you come to your own conclusion. Verses 17 to 25. You find the results of Ahaz's scheme. Remember, Ahaz's scheme was to conclude an alliance with Assyria in order to relieve himself of this threat from the northern kingdom and Syria. And what Isaiah does in 17 to 25 is to describe the ultimate effect of Ahaz's reliance on the king of Assyria. Notice verse 17. The Lord shall bring upon thee and upon thy people and upon thy father's house days that have not come from the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, even the king of Assyria. So you've made an alliance. That's all supposedly behind the scenes and quiet. But the Lord says that the king of Assyria is going to come on you. And it shall come to pass in that day the Lord shall hiss for the fly that is in the uttermost part of the rivers of Egypt, for the bee that is in the land of Assyria, and they shall come and shall rest all of them in the desolate valleys and the cleft of the rocks upon all thorns and upon all bushes. In the same day shall the Lord, notice the phraseology here, shave with a razor that is hired, namely by them beyond the river, by the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the feet, and it shall also consume the beard. So the Lord says that, or Isaiah says that the Lord will shave with a razor that is hired. The razor that is hired is Assyria. Assyria was hired by Ahaz, really, to shave Syria and Israel. But you see what Isaiah says, he's going to come and shave you. The Lord shall shave with the razor that is hired, namely by them beyond the river, by the king of Assyria, the head, the hair of the feet, and it shall consume the beard, and it shall come to pass in that day a man shall nourish a young cow and two sheep, and it shall come to pass for the abundance of milk, that they shall be he shall eat butter, for butter and honey shall everyone eat that is in the land. And it shall come to pass in that day that every place shall be where there were 1,000 vines worth 1,000 shekels of silver, it shall be for briars and thorns. With arrows, with bows shall men come, because all the land shall become briars and thorns. And all the hills shall be hoed with the mattock. There shall not come there the fear of briars and thorns, but it shall be for sending forth of oxen for the treading of fleshes. In other words, the conditions are going to be that agriculture will suffer, there's lack of cultivation, vineyards will be destroyed, there'll be grazing space, there will be butter and honey that don't require a lot of agricultural activity, not a lot of attention to produce, but there's devastation that's going to come on the land. The agent of that devastation is Assyria, the very country that Ahaz has put his trust in to deliver him from the northern kingdom and from Syria. Now, the eventuation or outcome of this alliance that Ahaz made with Assyria happened in the time of Hezekiah's son. And the eventuation of that alliance is described in detail in chapters 36 to 39 of Isaiah. That's that historical section that divides between the two major sections of the book. And in the time of Hezekiah, Ahaz's son, Sennacherib, comes up against Jerusalem. He attacks Judah, besieges Jerusalem, so that Hezekiah reaps what Ahaz sowed. And then the interesting thing is, if you look at chapter 36, verse 2, the time of Ahaz's son Hezekiah, when Sennacherib is threatening Jerusalem, you read, verse 2, the king of Assyria sent the Rabshakeh from Lachish to Jerusalem unto King Hezekiah with a great army. Notice the last phrase. He stood by the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the pool of Shiloh. You remember the occurrence of that before? Go back to Isaiah 7, verse 3. The Lord said to Isaiah, go forth, meet Ahaz, thou and Shiragash, thy son, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the pool of Shiloh. In other words, on the very spot where Isaiah had confronted Ahaz, telling him, trust the Lord, find your security and your deliverance and your confidence in the Lord, this threat against you is not going to stand. And Ahaz said, I don't want to ask for sign. Ahaz clearly did not want to trust the Lord. Instead, he trusted the Syrian and made alliance with the Syrian. In the very spot where Isaiah confronted Ahaz and warned him about that, the messenger of the king of Assyria stands and calls for Israel's surrender, the generation later. So that's the ultimate eventuation of Ahaz's conduct in that Syro Ephraimitic threat. Let's go on to chapter 8. We're still in this section of the book of Emmanuel. Seems that the historical background in chapter 8 and the general teaching in chapter 8 are similar to that of chapter 7. Verses 1 to 4 read, moreover, the Lord said unto me, take a great roll, write in it with a man's pen concerning Maher, Shaul, Hashbath. And I took unto me faithful witnesses to record, Uriah the priest, Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah. And I went in to the prophetess. She conceived and bore a son. Then said the Lord to me, call his name Mahershala of Ashbath. For before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father and my mother, the riches of Damascus, the spoil of Samaria, shall be taken away before the king of Assyria. Isaiah is told to write concerning, the Hebrew there reads, Limaher Shalal Hashbaz. King James translates that as the proper name, the last word there in 8:1. The NIV does as well, although the NIV has a text note that says, Maher Shalal Hashbaz means quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil. I think there's some question whether it should even be translated in that first instance as a proper name. Certainly it's clearly a symbolical name. The meaning of it is quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil. So take a large scroll, write on it with a pen, quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil. The English is just transliterated there. Now, it seems that the symbolism of the name, quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil, is that doom is coming to the two kingdoms of Israel and Syria, the northern kingdom and Syria. As is said in verse 4, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria shall be taken away. Destruction is coming on those two kingdoms. And eventually to Judah as well. Because if you go over to 10:6, you get the same vocabulary utilized with respect to Judah. See 10:5-6, O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, the staff in whose hand is mine indignation, I will send him against the hypocritical nation, against the people of my wrath, I will command him to take the spoil, to take the prey. To tread them down like the mire of the streets. Destruction is coming at the hands of the Assyrians on the northern kingdom, on Syria, on Judah as well, eventually. So, thus this name. Quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil. And then a sign is given, which is very similar to that of 7:14-16. But as I indicated here, I think the time period is shorter. Or the child will be able to say, my father or mother, Ami-Avi, which would be some of the first words that a child would speak. And here, the child is born to Isaiah, and it's clearly not a virgin birth. I went in unto the prophetess, verse 3 says, and she conceived. So it seems to me that the child here cannot be the same child that we refer to in chapter 7. The names are different. The mothers are different. 7:14 is clearly messianic. But what you find is, historically, that Syro-Eastern War, this 7:34, we talked about some of the case earlier, the fall of Damascus to Assyria was 7:32. So within 2 years of that threat from the northern kingdom of Syria, Damascus had fallen. Young says, the prophecy of the birth of Isaiah's son could be verified. It would thus be a pledge or earnest of the prophecy of the virgin son. That's similar to what Philip said. Young suggests there are two great figures coming. First, to the people of God, Emmanuel, who will bring salvation. And secondly, to Ahaz and his followers, Assyria and eventual devastation. And you find that in the 5th verse and following, Let's go on to verse 5. The Lord spoke unto me again, saying, For as much as this people refuses the waters of Shiloah that go softly, and rejoice in Rezin and Remaliah's son. Now, I think what that's saying is, as much as this people refuses the waters of Shiloah that go softly, and rejoice in, or with respect to Rezin and Remaliah's son, in other words, rejoice in their defeat. Now, therefore, behold, the Lord bringeth up upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria, and all his glory, and he shall come up over all its channels, go over all its banks. He shall pass through, notice what it says, not just the northern kingdom. He shall pass through Judah. He shall overflow, go over. He shall reach even to the neck, and the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, notice, O Emmanuel. 5-8 give the results again of Ahaz's alliance with Assyria. But foolish dependence on that heathen kingdom. Since the people, and here's the figure, will not trust the Lord, symbolized by those waters of Shiloah that go softly, since they won't trust the Lord, the people refuse the waters of Shiloah that go softly. Since they refuse to trust the Lord, the Lord is going to bring a mighty river on them that's going to inundate the land. And that mighty river is Assyria. See, verse 7. Therefore the Lord brings on them the waters of the river strong and mighty, even the king of Assyria. But the end of verse 8 is significant. That river is going to flood the land, as it were. It says it's going to go over its banks and channels. It's going to go up to the neck, but it's not going to totally overwhelm the land or be totally successful. And the reason for that is it is Emmanuel form. You see, he shall pass through Judah, overflow, go over, he shall reach even to the neck and stretch out of the wings, he shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel. It's not Ahaz's land, ultimately. It is Emmanuel's land. And because of that, the king of Assyria is really powerless to do what he wants to do, and that is totally take Judah. Not going to be permitted to do that. He can only go as far as the Lord permits him to do in carrying out his purposes of judgment on Judah. But that does not include the eradication of the land. Verses 9 and 10 show that the nations Assyria, Syria and Ephraim will not succeed in taking Judah. And you read in 9, Associate yourselves, O ye peoples, and ye shall be broken in pieces. Give ear, all ye far countries, gird yourselves, ye shall be broken in pieces. Gird yourselves, ye shall be broken in pieces. Take counsel together, and it shall come to naught. Speak the word, and it shall not stand. Why? For Emmanuel, for God is with us. For Emmanuel. Young says there, just as earlier, the fact of coming doom was symbolically expressed in the name of Isaiah's child, Ma'arechal Hashbaz, the plundered son. Doom symbolized in the name of Isaiah's child. So here, the fact of deliverance is given symbolical clothing in the name of the virgin's child, Emmanuel. It's an annual plan, so Assyria can only go as far as God permits Assyria to go. And it's not going to be able to completely take through it. Again, that prediction clearly fulfilled in the time of Hezekiah, second part of the book, or that middle section of the book, 36-39, where Assyria does come in the land, does overflow the land, overwhelm and come up with a net, but it's ready to take Jerusalem when the Lord intervenes and sends the plague against Macedonia and the army forced to retreat. And even though Sennacherib in his annal says that he closed up Hezekiah like a bird in a cage, doesn't say he couldn't. He didn't. He was forced to retreat. All right, 11-22 are words of exhortation to the Israelites in view of the current situation. Words of exhortation in view of the current situation. I'm not going to spend much time on those verses, but let's just read a few of them. 13 and 14. Sanctify the Lord of hosts himself. Let him be your fear. Let him be your dread. For he shall be for a sanctuary, but for a stone of stumbling, for a rock of offense, to both the houses of Israel, for a trap and for a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Don't fear the Assyrian. Fear the Lord. Sanctify the Lord himself. Let him be your fear. Let him be your dread. Verses 19 and 20. And when they shall say unto you, seek unto those who are mediums and unto wizards that teach and mutter, should not a people seek unto their God? Should not they seek on behalf of the living, to the dead, to the law, and to the testimony? If they speak not according to this word, it is because there is no light in them. So those words of exhortation in view of the current situation. Let's take a 10-minute break, and then we're going to move on into chapter 9. Verse 21 flows right on into chapter 9, and again we come into a messianic prophecy, given the context of Cyril and Hermit crisis. Yeah, from that
third. Yeah.
Seven till 21, another 13 years. But there, the Northern Kingdom was put under tribute to Assyria much earlier than that, shortly after the fall of Damascus. It's only the threat was removed, and the king was removed, Pekah was removed, so she was put in as a puppet by the Assyrians. Okay, back to 5 after.
Saying then that there's a close reference in the mind of the Israelites when they heard this Emmanuel those 2 times after the prophecy of the virgin birth.
I don't think so. I think the implication is that the land is Emmanuel's land, and therefore the Assyrians don't have total freedom to do what they want, or to accomplish completely what they would desire to accomplish, because it is a man of the time. Well, when the term is first used in 714, and then used so closely after it, must be a connection. See, there can be some question again whether you translate that as a name or whether you say, for God is with us, which is literally what it is. So you could say, you see, at 8 and this 8. At 8:08, he shall pass through Judah, shall overflow glory, shall reach into the neck, and the stretching out of the wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, for God is with us. Oh, Emmanuel. But the earth. Oh, they say, for God is with us in 10, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. They count together and they shall go to naught, speak the word and shall not stand, for God is with us. For Emmanuel. Even if you didn't translate it as a proper name in one of those or both of those places in Lee, it is identical wording as in 714, and 714 is clearly the proper name. So that it's certainly a play on that name. That is clear. I think you could. I think you could do it either way. No, I think you could say over and under. I thought there was a T there, but there isn't. Well, there is a T in 10. There is a T in 10. There isn't an 8. That's probably the difference with the NIV translation.